Welcome to another episode of the German Versatile Hunting Dog Files. I'm your host, Tim Moore, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Mike Murphy.
Hello, all. Thanks for tuning back in today. Tim has been kind enough, and he's lined up a couple of bird junkies to dispel or possibly confirm some of the myths of these sly game birds. We believe and hope that these guys can confirm the high level of addiction that these laughing devils can cause to the most strong-willed of hunters.
Well, today we've got Alec Luce joining us, and he will be sharing some of his hunting adventures of chasing these chucker and other Western game bird with his DK. And we are also joined by Matt Davis to talk with him about the Final Rise products and how his passion for hunting was the inspiration for the Summit Vest. Matt also has quite the reputation on the Chucker Hills, and we hope that he can pass some words of wisdom to those just getting started on their road to addiction and maybe share a tale or two with us today too. So before we get started, hit pause, go grab yourself a tall cold glass of your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and get ready to enjoy another episode of the German Versatile Hunting Dog Files. Before we kick things off today, I wanted to remind everybody that spring testing season is upon us, and that is usually accompanied by the various clubs' annual meetings. I want to urge every listener and club member, no matter what breed or club, to attend their annual meeting. These events are typically the pinnacle of the year. They provide a great opportunity to observe a spring test, meet fellow club members, stay current with club business, and most importantly, have a great time with people that share the same passion you do about these amazing breeds.
Yeah. So, okay, back to episode 11. Today we decided to switch gears a bit. We're going to break from test talk and hear some of the hunting adventures from a couple of diehard chucker junkies.
So I'm sure most of you guys have used chucker at some point in your training or even hunted with them at a local hunt club. But I got to tell you, you know, from the stories I hear, hunting them in their native habitat is quite different. These birds are as elusive as a 10 millimeter socket from your toolbox. They will make the toughest of hunters drop to their knees from chasing them up and down the valleys and over cliffs. But just when you think it can't get any worse, these birds seem to strip any dignity you have left when they laugh at you as they flush just out of range. Literally, they laugh at you. Well, you know, the noise they make when they flush kind of sounds like a chuckle or a chuck, 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 chuck. So that's close enough to laughing. So before you get started, decide to head west to get laughed at by some other chuckers, we ask you guys to listen closely to the tales of a couple of real life chucker hunters and possibly get a few tips to make your trip a little more fun. So let's get started. Welcome to the show, Alec and Matt, and thanks for coming on, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, for thanks, sure.
Guys, appreciate it.
Alec, you know, we're going to start off with you, bud, and why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Okay, my name's Alec Losey. Again, thanks for having us on here. I grew up in Utah, mostly grew up fly fishing and, but in the outdoors a ton. And then in high school, I got for lack of a better term, a backyard bred short hair, American short hair. Just off out here, we have something called KSL. It's kind of like what's it called?
Craigslist.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Craigslist, but it's just local to the area. Found a dog when I was a junior in high school for $250. And that was kind of it. Started hunting with him. He really got me more into the hunting sphere of things. My parents actually still own that dog. And then I went away to school in Georgia for a while, came back, and through actually another podcast, met Tyler Smith, who got me into DKs, and kind of the rest is history. And just been hunting my butt off ever since. Waterfowl, upland. Haven't really gotten into too many blood tracks yet, but I'm getting ready to do the VGP test probably next year. So gonna have to get into that pretty quick here.
Awesome. Thanks, Alec. And by the way, another Tyler Smith was the one who gave me your name, so you can blame him for that one. But
yeah, it's always his fault. If you don't know who to blame, you just blame him.
I get it. Yeah, we've had many conversations, and he's a good guy. So thanks, Tyler, if you're listening, buddy. Now, Matt, it's your turn to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Oh, shoot. Y'all, I guess my story's somewhat similar to Alex and somewhat different in a couple ways. Also from Utah, born and raised out this way, and grew up doing all sorts of hunting, upland, big game, kind of all of the above. I live in a beautiful valley where grouse are very plentiful. Both ruffs and blues are kind of just out my back door. And so growing up, even before I could hunt, I was always so excited to, you know, follow my dad and my brother around. And I was the Sherpa, the grouse Sherpa. I was always so stoked to, you know, be able to carry the birds that they'd shoot. And yeah, that's kind of what I cut my teeth on. And y'all did that for a long time. I went away. I served a mission for the church that I belonged to. So I was gone for a couple of years, came back, and got a job working in the outdoor industry for a company called Hoyt Archery, which is an archery manufacturer. If you're a bow hunter, you probably know who Hoyt is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a couple of years there, I unplugged from the upland side of things and was just very, very heavy into big game hunting. And spent a lot of time doing that. And, you know, after a couple of years, you know, I was like, God, I need to get back into dogs. And anyways, long story short, picked up another dog, and I don't big game hunt as much as I used to. So,
okay. Awesome. Well, thanks, Matt. You know, we appreciate that. And a little later in the show, we're going to give you some time to spotlight, you know, your final rise products, and we're going to talk to you and question you a little bit more about them too. So appreciate it.
So Matt and Alec, we put together a list of questions for you guys. We kind of sent you an outline to kind of let you know, hopefully you don't get too surprised. This is just a conversation that we're going to have with you guys to, you know, enlighten guys like me that are not associated with grouse hunting. I'm a pheasant hunting guy, so, and I love the dogs, and it's something that I've wanted to do, but the chucker hunting is something that seems to be you know, something that's kind of almost exclusive for you guys out west, because we don't, at least I don't think we have them around here. So why do you hunt chucker instead of grouse? Do you hunting, or I guess what separates them from the other game? How about it, Matt? Elaborate on that a little.
Oh, God. I mean, yeah, I'll take a crack at it, I guess. you know, chucker, to me, it's a pinnacle bird because of the amount of effort that it requires, not only from the hunter, but also from the dog itself. I'm not about going out and just shooting limits of anything, but it's pretty special, especially in Utah, the country here in Utah that we hunt chucker in, and Al can attest to this. It is probably more steeper and more rugged than any other chucker habitat that I've hunted. I've hunted Idaho. I would say there's some similar areas. Nevada, I mean, that's pretty easy walking, you know, chucker hunting, considering there's a side-by-side road to about anywhere out there, and the birds are plentiful. But anyways, I guess just, you know, cutting my teeth on them out here, it's just the amount of effort that it requires, and I really feel like I'm accomplishing something. Not that I'm not, when you go out and you're able to be successful with your dog on another species, but they're smart, they're fast, it's difficult wing shooting, and when it comes together, I don't know, I get more excited, or I get buck fever more when I see my dog locked up and I know he's got birds under his nose in the cliffs. I get more excited about that than when I'm putting the crosshairs on a deer or an elk or anything like that. Like it's that pinnacle for me.
Oh yeah. I can imagine. It's really, I mean, we around here, it seems like chucker, like Tim alluded to earlier, we use for birds, those chucker for tests, our DK tests, our DD tests, whatever. We use those birds because they seem to be a hardier bird. But, you know, we sometimes use quail and you know, a pen-raised quail versus a native quail. I mean, there's a world of difference in how they fly and how they elude you as a hunter. So you've got to have, I mean, a lot on the ball. I would think they you know, I mean, do they fly a lot? Are there similar flight patterns for a pen-raised bird versus a native bird? Does that sound like a question that maybe I've made clear? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, as far as shooting difficulty goes, right? You're just kind of curious, you know, how
yeah,
the birds are acting.
I mean, would I be seeing the same caliber of bird that I've been used to getting at a test or something here? Because I don't think, I mean, they're great flying birds here at test. That's why we use them. But, you know, just knowing that a native bird has, you know, a lot more to contend with, I would think that, and flying all its life, pen-raised bird, I would think they would even be more challenging to hit with a shotgun. So,
well, yeah. Murph, you have trouble hitting them pen-raised pheasants, so I don't know about the, you know, I'm just saying, I mean, you know, so if you're asking if they're going to be easy to hit, I'm going to say it's going to be like a wild rooster is my guess. Does that sound about right, guys?
I would
just go ahead.
I was gonna say I'd take a wild rooster over a chuckered about 9 times out of 10. You can't practice for the kind of stuff that chucker do. I mean, you go out, you're shooting pen raised birds, wild grouse, anything else. I mean, they're flying up, so you're tracking that bird up with your gun. When you start hunting chucker, I mean, you're typically your dog. Maybe uphill, downhill, side hill, whatever it is, mm-hmm. but you're aiming your gun down. And so to make that switch from, say, a pen raised chucker or even a wild pheasant or a sharp tail, whatever it is, all of a sudden, instead of aiming your gun up into the air, you're aiming it down. And it just, I mean, it's a total ball game change for me. I don't know about sure. you, Matt, but.
Oh, yeah.
The sky's falling out from under them, right? I mean, these birds, the whole strategy is to get above them, right? Because the birds will run uphill from you. So a lot of people, you know, they fart around in the foothills and halfway up the mountain and they wonder why they don't find birds. Well, the birds are at the top, right? So you get to the top and you work the ridges. You're obviously letting the dog work the wind and the thermals as those are coming up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously a higher percentage of finds when you're putting that dog in an opportunity and a position to be successful. And then the dog goes on point and you're just hoping that those birds are going to hold while you're trying to stay on your feet. I mean, you're going down the cliffs and sometimes you don't even know where your dog is. And even when you've got the GPS tracker, you can't see him because just the way the cliffs, the mm-hmm. topography and everything's shaped. I mean, you have no idea where those birds are. And it's just it's a total guess, and you have a fraction of a millisecond to shoot.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I read somewhere, and maybe one of you two can get a chuckle out of this, and maybe some of our other listeners will too. They say the chucker's creed is to run up and fly down, and they, you know, and the one guy comedy says, he goes, I'm still expecting to find that tattooed on a bird somewhere someday, you know, like that's their instruction manual, you know, run up fly down. So yeah, sounds from exactly like what Matt's saying. They're, you know, just crazy, and I can picture the way you're describing it, Alec, where, you know, you're so used to bringing your gun from, you know, horizontal to up to the horizon, whereas if you're aiming down a hill, it's just a whole other ball game, right? Or you know, a mountainside, if you'll say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're not, even when you go shoot clays, you're not throwing them downhill. So, like, mm-hmm. it doesn't prepare you for that. I mean, they take those little, I guess you call them J-hooks, and, I mean, they'll eventually come back to that same altitude. I have found that if you find them at, say, 6,500 feet, once they flush, you give them a minute to settle. I mean, hiking over wherever you think they went, that'll give them a minute. Mm-hmm. But they usually typically end up at a similar elevation as before.
Okay. And would you say, you know, I've been out west a handful of times, you know, sharp tail and prairie chicken hunting, and Murph's been with me, and he knows that, you know, them birds, you know, you got to bust that covey up, right? And then finally, once you get that covey pop two or three times, you can usually split them. And by that point, you know, the third flush, you know, you're usually able to pin them down, right? Now, the question being is, are chucker the same way? Are they going to, do you have to kind of pop them several times to get them to move, or will they hold a little better?
Go ahead, Alec.
I think my rule of thumb for chucker is don't try to figure them out because you're going to be wrong. but because, I mean, even with the run up and fly down, as soon as I started thinking that, it was actually, I mean, I'd probably only seen different once or twice. And I took my dad out a couple weekends ago on the closer for Utah, and dogs locked up, had them pinned down. We start walking in there, and I mean, we were coming down on top of them. Dogs were, had them pointed from each side, and they flew right over our heads. So when we're walking down, we're like, all right, we're pressuring them from the top. They're going to fly downhill, mm-hmm. easy shots. And they started bailing out over our heads, over the dogs, and like two birds flew downhill. And so, I mean, as soon as you start trying to figure those birds out, that's when you're going to get messed up. But I think they're probably pretty famous, and Matt, you can either confirm or deny, but they like to popcorn flush pretty bad. I mean, you're always fumbling. If you're shooting an over-under, you're always fumbling to get your next rounds in because you never know how many birds are really sitting in that covey. But, okay. I mean, you'll get two pop-up, three pop-up, five pop-up, and eventually they'll find each other and make a big covey again, but you can pick whichever covey or whichever group seems the easiest to go after the next time.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys sound like you got to be pretty much a mountain goat to hunt these guys.
Yeah.
I mean it sounds like it would be a challenge just to be able to keep pace with, you know, the terrain that you have to go over. So is this a lot of public ground that you guys hunt on, or private? I got to believe it's a lot of public ground, but I don't know. I mean, you used to go out and find a spot and say, let's go.
Yeah, I think that's one of the wonderful things about out west. You know, there's so much public ground. I don't think I've ever hunted chucker on private ground now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact that I haven't actually, you know. I mean, sometimes you have to drive through ranches and different things like that that have, you know, a right of way, I guess. But yeah, all the ground is state or federal ground that's.
So do you run into a lot of other
one of us?
The hunter population out there is, do you guys say, oh man, I'm going to this spot tomorrow, and you get out there and there's two trucks there, or do you do a lot of other guys that are doing the same thing that you're doing?
For me, you know, I've got three or four buddies that I hunt with, but in as long as I've chucker hunted, you know, I've probably got 10 years on me now of chucker hunting. I have only ever run into one person on the mountain, and I've only seen two other people from like afar.
So yeah, with all that ground, yeah, I can imagine it would be, you'd have a lot of it to yourself a lot of the time. So, but yeah. That's pretty cool. So, while you're out there doing all this, that's what you're here for.
I was going to say, if you pull up to a spot and that you had planned on hunting and there's somebody already there, typically one of your friends has a big mouth.
Well, that's always a problem, you know, once you, and we have the same problem here, you know, I mean, you start, you know, talking and all you got to do, you don't have to be even area specific. You could just say, hey, I went out yesterday, and they've got a pretty good idea where you might've been. So, But for the most part, I think that's, there's some similarities that with all upland game, but that's why I'm curious. So when you're out chucker hunting, you run across a grouse and maybe even a pheasant or two on now and then, or is it mostly just the terrain's just going to hold chucker?
Matt?
No. Yeah, both of us are like, no, I mean, chucker country is chucker country. I mean, there's, you know, where most of the places we hunt grouse are more forested, wooded areas, you know, steeper mountains, pine trees, quakies, scrub oak, different stuff like that. So the kind of just different spectrums. There's one or two places where you might be able to hunt one side of a range and kill some grouse and then drive to the other and then shoot chucker on that. But the habitat, for what I have hunted, has been pretty distinct. You know, where chucker live, there's maybe, you know, some sheep, as far like mountain sheep, or what am I trying to say here? Like bighorns, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's not, and big mule deer. There's some big mule deer, but other than that, it's chucker, rocks, sheep, and maybe a couple deer. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd kind of add, I mean, with the chucker country, it's one of those things that comes back to, and I guess I didn't add this in my about me, but, which I'm probably going to get beat for later, but, I actually live in Idaho now. I moved up here. My wife and I moved in with her and we got married, and from where I'm at now, we're about 45 minutes into great sharp tail, 45 minutes into some awesome sage grouse. I mean, we have a pretty limited season here, but it's still pretty awesome hunting, see lots of birds. And so it comes back to the debate that's also in the fishing world too, of native fish and native birds versus these implants, stuff from overseas. And it's kind of why I do like to side with chucker, is they're not taking habitat, you know, pheasants and stuff. They could encroach, huns can encroach on sharptail habitat, but you get chucker and it's like, they're not pushing anything out. Nothing else wants to live there. So it's kind of a unique spot where you're finding pretty much only chucker.
And the numbers have been good for you guys, huh?
Here and there.
Yeah, I mean, chuckers kind of have, you know, they have cycles. They'll get really high dense populations and they kind of have crashes. And, you know, Utah has a very long season, and, you know, there's a lot of people that don't agree with how late it goes because there's potential for, you know, paired up birds to be shot and different things like that. And so there's some debate there, but everybody has their own ethical scale and they can do what they feel is right. But I mean, God, when I first started chucker hunting, I thought it was hard, you know, the terrain, but there were just so many birds. It was one of those things, you could hike a single ridge and if you didn't shoot a limit of birds, it was your own damn fault, you know. But now really I guess the equation that I'll give guys when they're coming out or they want to hunt, and, you know, I'm going to tell them, hey, we're going to hike for probably 2 hours before we get to where the birds are. And then you've got it. My equation is, it's like, you know, every 2 or 3 miles, you'll find a covey of birds. So okay. I'm anticipating doing 8 to 10 miles on each one of those hunts. And there's other areas that are, you know, have denser populations. I mean, we've been out to Nevada and Idaho, and some of those hunts, they're, you know, 50-minute hunts. I mean, there's just giant coveys in low locations, but usually mm-hmm. you're doing a lot of walking and not a lot of shooting.
Okay. That sounds like a lot of upland hunting anymore. I mean, I think all game is kind of, it's not like it was, you know, several years ago, but the literature that I've read says that, you know, the hunting really doesn't have a huge impact on the population. So whether or not that's true, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could look and find, you know, arguments anyway for a lot of different topics, but yeah, it says that, you know, they're a difficult bird to hunt and that they are. The hunting is the least of the problems, more of the predators, the normal cycle of life. They don't live, you know, they don't have a big life cycle, I guess. So, you know, yeah. Longevity isn't for them. So Alec, you got a DK, right?
I do.
So in training the DK and the versatility of the dog, I mean, I'm sure it sounds like you have a, you know, a real opportunity to hunt in a lot of different, types of terrain and different species of birds. So the dogs, the testing and the training of the dog is really kind of paid off in that direction for you, you think? Or how do you feel?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, When you get to where we live right here, we are 5 minutes to the Snake River. And we go shoot ducks down in there and geese. And then, like I said, 45 minutes to some awesome sharptail huns we have locally. And so it's a great spot for all that. And one of the things that we like to do during the season is we'll kind of set a couple weekends aside and be like, we're going to have, we just like to call them versatile weekends, you know, where we'll go do upland Saturday morning, finish with ducks Saturday night, and then go to upland and ducks again the next day. And just kind of have those mixed days where you go hike your butt off in the morning and then go sit in a blind in the afternoon.
Yeehaw, that sounds like a good time. So the dogs really paid off for you. I'm kind of curious as to, now, being a pheasant hunter, it's not uncommon to shoot a pheasant. Guys come down, he's landed. Oh, yeah, the bird landed over here, putting the dog on it, and here's the pheasants ran 100 yards, and the dog's got to track it down, and you know, it's not been a clean kill. It sounds like chuck are pretty tough to hit. So will they run like a pheasant? I mean, during training.
I mean, so force fetch, I think, is, I mean, it's really important with duck hunting, any kind of hunting, really, just to retrieve that game. But when it comes to chucker, I mean, these birds, even after you hit them, they can go down. I mean, they lock their wings out and they can end up 200 yards plus down mountain from you.
Sure.
And so if you don't have a dog that has the trained retrieve, you're going to add almost double. If you're shooting birds, you're going to double your hike that day up and down mountains just to get your birds. And so I don't know how much they run after getting hit, but I mean, they will tuck themselves in. They'll climb in crevices. I had I think it was probably 2 years ago now, when Cody was just a puppy, hit a bird, saw it go down hard. He went down there and went back on point. And I got down there and I was like looking all over. I'm like, where's this bird? I know it went down right here somewhere. And this thing had crawled like 3 feet back into these rocks. And I ended up having to like shove my arm down in there and pull this bird out, because there's no way the dog was getting in there. But I mean, they are tough birds. They're definitely hardy.
Oh man. I see that when we use them to train. We can put a bird down, and them suckers, they'll move quite a ways. You know, I mean, that's just, you're dizzy a bird to do your training and stuff, you know, so they're liberated. But I was just wondering how you kind of answered that question, how far they'll go after they're shot. So, but yeah, so you guys, I mean, it's gotta be it's gotta be something you guys, Matt, you've been doing this for a while, as well as Alec. Is there something that drives you to want to do this? What might it be?
I guess for me, I think it's the challenge. I think, you know, there's a saying about chucker hunters that we've got big legs and little heads. Maybe we're a little dumb. man, it's so much of the challenge. I love the exercise. I love being able to get out. Obviously, the dogs are a gigantic part of that. You know, a good chucker dog is an incredible thing to watch, to me. And I do. I mean, we hunt everything. I mean, I spend a lot of times up around where Alec lives at, and we do a lot of sharptail, a lot of pheasant, quail. Well, I used to do sage grouse there until they wanted non-residents to pay $75 for one bird. I said, screw that, but more power to them. no, but just, you know, I've a good hard chucker dog. I feel like that country is really tough. I feel like it wears on a dog, but it just makes them super tough. And so, I don't know. I feel like, you know, and we'll talk about it later with gear and different things like that as well. But I feel like anything that can do very well in the chucker hills, you know, killing wild birds, it's going to be able to excel in any upland application and do very, very well.
Now I got a couple questions for both of you guys. And again, to something you said there, you know, I think it was Matt said that, you know, plan to hike a few miles in before you really even begin to hunt, you know, on that, that hike there, knowing that these dogs, and obviously these dogs are conditioned, right? You're not taking the weekend warrior dog out for to the Chucker Hills, right? You know, I've seen it time and time again. We've had friends here that hunt birds local at state grounds or, you know, are put and takes or even hunt clubs, and they go out west and they come back from 3 days and their dog is just spent for weeks, right? Again, conditioning. We know that through training, you know, like Alec talked about and, you know, so forth, and just conditioning of a dog. We're getting ready for a season. But when you're hiking in, do you kind of keep your dogs at a calm walk to you, or do you kind of just let them kind of roam about freely? And that, does that slow them down and get that piss and vinegar out of them, per se, by the time they actually get in, the birds are a little more apt to be cautious?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, you know, I let the dogs run. I mean, okay. You know, get them out, drop the dogs and start following them and let them do that. I mean, there have been plenty of times, you know, as the season progresses and, you know, north facing slopes get snow and birds are congregated, they may move down lower and stuff like that. I mean, there's those very, very limited times where you're finding birds, you know, halfway up the hill. So it definitely does happen, but, I just let them run. I let the dog, I don't like a sticky dog, I guess. I mean, I'm most of my dogs are hunting, you know, 200-300 yard dogs for most of the time. Anything beyond that, I feel like it's kind of diminishing returns, especially on chucker. You know, I've got buddies that have very big running dogs, and you know, they'll go on 0.8-9 thousand yards away, and you're, I mean, chucker country's steep, right? I mean, 200 sure. yards in chucker countries, that's a pretty good little poke. It's going to take you a minute to get over there. You know, Alec was talking about relocating birds. I mean, you can start hiking right after they flush, because I promise it'll take you more than a minute to get over to the next ridge, you know? So, anyways, I let the dogs run and let them do their thing.
Now do these dogs, okay, so the dog, you know, you let them range out that far. Dog sticks a covey, right? We got a solid point going on here, guys. How's that covey hold? I mean, are they real spooky, or what's usually their nature right out the gate, first point on them, first time you're busting a covey?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that has to do with that. You know, if depending on the area you're hunting, it matters, you know, how many times those birds have potentially been contacted. You know, it might be a young covey of birds with only a handful of mature birds. I mean, it's hard to know. And I think that's part of the draw factor to chucker, is it's never set in stone, and it never is with any bird, right? But being able to locate a dog, you know, at, you know, 100-200 yards away and seeing where that dog is, a lot of times, you know, Alec talked to these birds popcorning, and, you know, if you want to shoot birds, it especially chucker, and it, I guess this is applicable in any upland application, but it's how you approach the dog, right? Where you're anticipating those birds to be, and you do it enough and you have a pretty good idea, and occasionally you get a curveball and they jump over the top of you, like Alex said. But man, if I can get 50-60 yards down below my dog in the direction he's pointing, you know, understanding the wind and stuff like that, and it just gives you a chance to kind of create a game plan and get on those birds. And you know, they may see you and just decide they've had enough and they're going to jump, but they may see or feel that additional pressure and decide they're going to hold. And if you got a good dog that's just standing on them and doing well with his birds, you got a really good chance of getting shots.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm gonna get back to Murph's timeline here, because if I don't, he'll start yelling at me. So, Murph, what's the next question we got for these gentlemen?
Well, hey, Tim, you printed a question on here for Alec that you had recently talked
to. Oh, yeah. So let me ask you, Alec. You know, when we were talking initially, you know, you commented to me and used the phrase "off the sauce," right? And we know what that means in regular lingo. But go ahead and talk to that. You know, you're off the sauce, meaning the chucker these days. So how addicted to chucker were you before you got off the sauce?
Yeah, I mean, when I was still living in Utah, I actually lived in Eagle Mountain, which Matt probably knows where it is. But for you guys who don't, it's out on the west side of Utah Lake. And, I mean, it's the gateway to chucker country, really, for a lot of us, for a lot of the areas you go hit in Utah. But where I was living, I didn't always shoot into them, but I could be in Chucker in 15 minutes, hiking out the back of my drive up, 5 minutes, start hiking, and in 10 minutes, I was shooting birds. And those are actually, that's actually the first, well, I guess second bird contact that my DK had as a puppy was wild Chucker right behind my house. And at that time, whether I was going up on that hill or heading out even further west and just diving into the West Desert out there, I was probably 3-4 days a week, just hunting Chucker. I was technically in school, but God that bless. Was that was 2 days a week, and most of it was online. So I would just load the dog up, go grab the dog from my parents' house, so I could switch dogs off, especially with a puppy like that, and just go out there and spend a couple days shooting birds.
Okay. And
yeah, it's addicting.
Okay. So now you've made the jump. Like you said, you're recently married. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
You know, and you know, you're in Idaho. Obviously you said you've kind of switched gears a little bit. You kind of downgraded a little bit as far as speed wise, the birds you're chasing. Tell our listeners a little bit about what you've kind of switched your gears to and the differences in the hunt and the style of the hunt, what you're doing.
Yeah, so I hunt a lot of Hungarian partridge now, still wild birds. One of my buddies who actually has a litter mate of my DK, he calls them Fat Man's Chucker. And they're very similar in a lot of aspects. They're very similar, but you're hiking in pretty flat ground, at least relatively flat ground.
Okay.
Through sagebrush and stuff. They fly hard still. I found they won't popcorn flush as much, so it's not quite as easy to get into a lot of birds, but they're really fun. And then sharp tail, like I said, they're 45 minutes from the house. I find a lot of joy in that because it's, I mean, native wild birds, not only wild, but I mean, they're from here. And so shooting into those is always a blast. And now probably sage grouse might be my favorite that is within a close proximity. And like Matt was saying, we kind of hit the non-residents on it these last couple years. this last year, we actually switched to a single bird tag.
Really? So
you have to buy a tag, almost like a big game permit. Luckily for us locals, it's only $35, but it's still $35 for one bird.
And what's it for a non-resident?
75.
You know, 75 for one bird, right?
Yeah. That's an annual license to Wyoming for small game, in case anyone's wondering.
And again, if I was to come out to you, you know, it's one of them arguments that we've had time and time again, and not to get on a different topic, but we go out west and, you know, it's quality. You know, you think about it and you're like, you're going to cheap out on a box of shells, right? You know, I'm not going to shoot this or that. And a couple years ago, a good handful of us started shooting boss shells. And I'm a believer, man. I'll tell you, I've knocked some birds down and made some shots with waterfowl, with upland, that were just tremendous, clean kills. Everybody I've talked to. So again, you know, you're going to cheap out and say, well, I'm not going to pay $28 on a box of shells, right? As opposed to $18 for some cheaper ones or something like that, or good steel shells. Same thing. If I'm going to go out there, yeah, it's a pain to think to yourself, I'm going to pay $75 for one bird, but heck, I might not be back to Idaho again. So I guess I would pay it, but I do see your point. Actually, it's extremely painful to think that. So,
And it is like on that point though, it's, and I'm sure for Matt, and this might be how he thinks about it. I don't want to speak for him, but I have a couple buddies that think this way of Idaho. You're paying $75 a bird if you're a non-resident, and you only get one, where you can cruise up to Wyoming. They've got a 10-day season. You can shoot, I think it's two birds a day now, and have a bag limit of four, or have a
possession limit. Yeah.
Possession limit of four. And Montana, they kind of fly under the radar. So if I'm ruining Montana for somebody, I'm sorry, but they have quite the sage grouse season.
Okay.
And same with Nevada. And I think Utah's still a draw, I think, Matt.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So
interesting, because you know, Nevada. I didn't think of that one there, but and again, it's neat. I don't know, either of you guys watch the TV series Meat Hunter at all? Meat Eater.
Yeah.
Did you see him when he went out sage grouse hunting? That was kind of comical. So yeah. he wound up shooting a rabbit, and needless to say, so if you're out, be careful, and it's warm like that, don't be shooting the rabbits. They're full of fleas, guys. And if you do, don't put them in your game bag. You'll be itching the rest of the trip. But
mostly don't shoot those jacks kind of in general. You don't win much off shooting those jacks. They're kind of gross.
Yeah. Okay. Never been jackrabbit hunting either. So that's something to put on the list somewhere along the way, just to say I've done it. Right. And, you know, and I guess all of these Western game birds, guys, you know, when you think about it, you know, I heard somebody compare sharp tails or prairie chickens one time that says, you know, the first time you go hunting for them grouse is for fun. Every time after that is for revenge. So, you know, I don't know if that lends true with some of the stuff you're saying about the sage grouse and everything too, if they're a little difficult, but, cool. All right, Murph, what's next? What do we got next, buddy?
Well, we want to talk just a little bit, you know, as far as the DK. I mean, we know you use it on all these birds. So, because we are the German, versatile hunting dog file. So, the DK for you said you had a backyard German Shorthair or backyard bred German Shorthair, and now you have a DK. You've been happy with the dog, I take it, because you still got him, right?
Yep, I do.
So he handles, I mean, has he learned to handle the birds differently, say, between, you said you've been now recently Hungarian part of the Huns and the Sharpies. I mean, they're the same but different, right? When you're hunting, so the dog's got to maybe adjust also to that type of hunting.
Yeah, so Huns and Sharpies, typically, and pheasant even, you'll find them in very similar ground out here, at least in our area here. And so they, most of those, I mean, they're hunting them pretty similar. But one of the things that's really amazed me with the DKs, and I mean, a lot of dogs do it. I've seen plenty of other dogs do it, but definitely with Cody, was changing his hunting style for not necessarily the bird we're hunting, but the ground he's trying to cover. I mean, I'll take him up and do rough grouse, and he's sticking 30, 40 yards in those thick woods. And I mean, there's big concentrations of rough grouse, so that's all he really needs to do. And mm-hmm. just really methodical back and forth right in front of me, but just tight, not missing a spot. And then we'll go out and do chucker, and he's pushing 200 yards. And so he just adjusts to those different scenarios really well. And then I can throw him in a duck blind, and he sits down, shuts up, and does really well in the cold too.
So yeah, you just mentioned earlier, you're going to be attempting a VGP with the dog here in the upcoming future. So, I mean, out west, I mean, are you going to be testing out where you're at out west? Are you traveling to a VGP?
So
or you don't know yet. We
have a pretty good squad out here. Utah kind of, actually really Tyler Smith, kind of kicked up a lot of stuff and started a pretty big movement in Utah, to where I've got quite a few friends with them. And we're actually hosting I'm part of the DKGNA, which is the other group, Dortch Kurtzar Group North America. Yep. And we're Utah's hosting the annual meeting for them with the Derby. And we're actually expecting 30 dogs in the Derby. So we have four judging groups going.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty great. There's a huge group of them. And then I think the VGP, obviously it's not on the schedule yet, but there's one this year. Mm-hmm. For, I think it's in Walla Walla, Washington.
Sure.
Which is where the president of the DKGNA lives. And I'm actually getting a female out of, hopefully, if everything lines up right, getting a female out of his next litter.
Okay.
And then, yeah, hopefully that VGP up there. I would like to go watch it just so I can get one under my belt, just watching. And then that next year I would look for the VGP somewhere locally. Hopefully don't have to go too far.
That's kind of where I was coming off at, because I mean, where you're at, your location, I'm just wondering about the forest work and versus, you know, the field work. And when you started talking about your dog adjusting to the terrain that you were hunting in, I mean, that's a huge thing for your VGP testing. I mean, and that's one of the things that is, you know, highlighted in the VGP between the dense forest search and the field search and the, you know, the water work and whatnot. So, mm-hmm. So I've just kind of, it kind of plays right into your hunting. So it's really neat the way that, you know, that the test is, it really helps you prepare your dog for the hunting that you're doing. So kudos. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. And you know, there's a guy that you said a bunch of dogs out there. I think one of my good buddies here has a pup out of Scott Jacobs bee litter, I think it was. And then I think there's another guy local somewhere in our, that might be running our derby at our annual meeting, Murph, that's got a pup out of Scott as well too. So, and I've had an opportunity to hunt behind that dog. Just a nice dog. So kind of well put together, and I can't recall the parents off the top of my head, but yeah, so awesome. Well, good deal, man. Sounds like you guys got a good event coming up, Alex. So that's pretty cool. So
yeah. Our annual meeting is also coming up. That's what Tim alluded to first. You know, I mean, you guys' annual meeting's coming up for the DKGNA, the NADKC. We're actually hosting it here in right along the Mississippi River this year. So we've got the same thing going on. We've got, I don't think we've got 30, but I think we've got a good number of young dogs that are going to run in the Derby this year also. So hopefully, yeah. You know, that lends to getting puppies out to more people in the future, I guess. So,
hey, absolutely.
I'm gonna do this right now. And cause we're starting to get a little long. So,
okay.
I want to ask Alec and Matt a couple of last questions. And this is just before we put Matt on the hot seat about, you know, his gear and stuff. So, okay, so I'm going to start with you, Alec. If you could give your listeners one piece of advice, if they were to come west to go chucker hunting, what are you going to tell me? If I come out, you know, hey, just give me one sentence or give me one tidbit that you would say, this is, you know, this would help you in your hunting efforts.
Honestly, spend the money on the gear. And I know Matt's going to probably highlight that for a while here in a minute, but good gear goes a long ways. You get up, you know, some of those pants are heavier, stiffer, or I guess soft boots would be a negative in the chucker country. But you get up there and you can beat yourself up in half the time that you normally would just by having bad gear. I mean, having a big, heavy pack, having heavy boots, having heavy pants. You spend that extra money, you're going to get more breathable gear, lighter gear that can just really hold with you and keep up with you better and actually let you have a good time and condition your dog. I've had a couple buddies come from out east and bring their dogs. And I mean, you add altitude and thinner air, dry air. Chucker country doesn't have a lot of water, so you better be able to pack some water. And if those dogs, especially their pads get blown a lot in the chucker hills if dogs mm-hmm. aren't used to it. But and then, like I said, Matt's probably going to talk about it for a little bit here, but one of the great things I found with his vest actually is the water capabilities. Like early season, when it is still hot and going in an area that doesn't have a lot of water, I'll actually have both water bottle holders filled and I'll have a bladder in the pack, and bladders for me and the water bottles on the side are for the dogs, and just having as much water as possible. You'll never gets a little heavier, but you'll never curse yourself for having too much water.
Well, I think you stole all of Matt's answers, by the way, there, Alex. I mean, we had a little text thread going on earlier. I'm seeing a bunch of emojis coming across that thing. So, well, Matt, so, okay. Matt, same question to you. Or I'm sorry, Murph, go ahead.
No, go ahead. That's exactly what I was going to ask. I was going to ask Matt.
Matt, same question to you. And obviously, you know, this is like Family Feud. You cannot repeat the answer, otherwise you're going to hear the buzzer noise, all right?
Yeah, no joke. I mean, I was definitely going to touch on gear, and Alec nailed that. I would say go into it being prepared yourself. I think a lot of times people think that good gear and good dogs is a supplement to being prepared themselves. And if you're going to come out here, if you're going to spend the time, if you're going to spend the money, if you're going to drive out here, I'm a huge advocate for being healthy, for exercising. I mean, that's a big part of my life as well currently. And probably one of the reasons, again, that I enjoy chukar hunting. But come out just knowing it's going to be hard. I think guys get out here, they go one time, they don't see birds, it was hard, they get, you know, deflated that it just wasn't what they expected. But if you know, don't be upset at the results you don't get from the work that you didn't put in. So
Okay, awesome.
All right, yeah, cool. All right, so here we go, the last question for you, Alec, before we get with Matt here. I'm gonna tell us your favorite hunting story with your DK, something that has been a good memory for you, I guess, for hunting with your dog.
Oh man. That was probably the first time actually that I hunted with my now wife. I came up here and we hunted sharptail, in one of our go-to spots now. Cody, my DK, was 12 weeks old, 13 weeks old maybe at the time. And we went out there. I had my older short hair, who at this point had already had hundreds of birds shot over him. And about 20 minutes in, dogs lock up. And, I mean, Cody's kind of doing puppy things, you know, pointing, creeping, pointing. But birds popped up. I knocked a bird down, and it went down in this briar thicket. And go in there, send the dogs in, and my short hair searching around. My wife's wire hair was searching around. And Cody kind of runs up to me and disappears off to the side. And I'm like, you know what? I'll find him in a minute. Let's find this bird. And about 2 minutes later, I look over, and 200 yards away is my 12-week-old puppy carrying the sharp tail in his mouth. And it had hit the ground and booked it out of there. And he had tracked it all the way over down into this ditch and was bringing it all the way back to me. I mean, obviously way before force fetch, any of that. And I mean, I'd always heard, Tyler had told me a million times, that one of the biggest parts of these dogs is their retrieval, and the after the shot work will really set them apart. And that was kind of also the moment that I was like, yeah, this is the right breed for me. And I mean, it was just such a cool experience seeing that little dog punk the two older dogs and come running in from 200 yards with that sharp tail.
Oh man. Yeah. Yeah.
Love it.
That's a great story. So yeah. Love all it. Right. Well, Tim, it's up to you now. Thanks, Alec. So, hang in there with us for a little bit. I think, we want to kind of pick, Matt's brain a little bit here. So Tim.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. So, you know, guys, at the end of 2019, I decided, you know, making some trips out west, doing some different things, just like these guys talked about earlier in their closing comments about advice for going west. I hunted with a guy. He had a top end strap vest from one of the other companies out there. And I said to myself, you know what, I'm going to invest some money in this. So after talking to several guys, I knew some guys that had Wing Works, some guys that had, I think, the Q5. And I'd seen Final Rise all over the internet and Facebook and stuff. It kind of left me wondering what was the right vest for me. So, you know, I didn't know anybody that had a Final Rise vest at the time. So I picked up my phone and I sent Matt a message and got to talking to him back and forth. Not only did he answer all my questions, he answered them quickly, you know, respond time wise. I'm thinking, well, this guy's on top of it. After several rounds of messages back and forth and conversation, on the phone with them, I knew, you know, my decision was made. So I put my order into Matt. 6 weeks later, the vest arrives at the house, and, you know, now the real test was about to come, right? You know, and after an entire training season, You know, testing season, local weekend hunting here, and multiple road trips to multiple different states, many miles on the boots and many birds in the bag. I'm here to tell you guys, this vest is like no other and it's worth every penny. You know, I can't get over how awesome it is and how much it made my hunting season that much more enjoyable. So Matt, you know, thanks again for coming on the show, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your products and how your products came to be and Final Rise came to be. So why don't you tell the listeners a little bit more about how it all got started?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, Tim, and that's an incredible compliment. I always, you know, a lot of people are reaching out, and there's a lot of great products out there, and at the end of the day, I hope that people are getting what's right for them. And even if it isn't a product that we make, you know, at the end of the day, as long as people are getting out and being able to enjoy what we've been talking about this whole time, you know, that's a win for the upland community as a whole. And so to be able to pour our heart and soul into something and have people value and appreciate it, you know, that means an incredible amount to us. So we're just very grateful to be a part of that conversation and be included in that search as people are really looking to upgrade their gear. And so kind of I guess maybe how Final Rise came to be, you know, early on, as I kind of talked a little bit about, you know, we were kind of doing our intros there, I alluded to, you know, a lot of the big game hunting that I've done, and I'm not a very old individual by any means. I'm 31 years old, but I've spent I've been fortunate to work in the outdoor space basically my entire professional career for about 12 years now. I worked for Hoyt, and then for the past 6 years, I've been working for a nutrition company called Mountain Ops, which is a health performance company that's kind of made, you know, supplements more catered towards outdoor enthusiasts, hunters, different things like that. So I've been fortunate to do something that I love for so long, and, you know, in that process, I've got great friends at, you know, the major pack manufacturers, you know, whether that's Kufaru, Mystery Ranch, Kuyu, a lot of these very pinnacle Western companies. And I've been fortunate, you know, to be able to use a lot of that gear. You know, I spend a couple weeks every single fall living out of a backpack. And it's just something I enjoy, and it's fun to mix it in. And I enjoy the challenge of big game hunting as well. It's definitely not as enjoyable as upland hunting is for me, but I greatly enjoy it still. And so anyways, I guess why I'm sharing that and why I feel that's kind of pertinent to how Final Rise came to be, you know, as I looked at the upland market, you know, it was, there's some of the great companies that you had mentioned, Tim. You know, you had a Wingworks, mm-hmm. and had the Q5, and it was a pretty quiet market, right? There wasn't a lot of innovation or updates or really a big emphasis on the gear side of things that was happening in the upland space. And, you know, so I just, you know, for me, kicks and giggles, I'm like, you know, I'm going to sew a couple of vests. My parents owned an industrial sewing business as I was growing up. So I learned to sew at a very young age. You know, all the gear that I've been talking about, packs, camo, different things like that, I was constantly tweaking and modifying and changing them to my personal liking, to do exactly what I wanted it to do. And anyways, so sewed a couple of packs for me and a few of my hunting buddies. And, mm-hmm. you know, I really had no intention of doing anything with it. I just thought it was, you know, it was cool to make my own vest. And I thought it was great. And we were having a great time, and we tested them and we tweaked them. And then we kind of just all made, I guess, production models for ourselves.
Okay.
And, you know, one of my buddies was like, dude, you should think about, you know, selling these or doing something with it. And for me, I still have a full-time job. A lot of people don't know that, but I still work full-time for Mountain Ops, and okay. they've been very kind to me. It's been a wonderful, wonderful company to work for. And so it wasn't like, I guess I didn't necessarily need it, and I was already busy. And anyways, I was just like, man, well, you know, I'll think about it. And, you know, kind of started again, looking at the marketplace. I'm like, you know what, maybe there's an opportunity here to, you know, be able to raise the standard and raise the bar of the gear that's being offered. And maybe just, you know, create a little bit of that fire. I'm a firm believer that, you know, I guess competition is a good thing. I feel like it brings the best out of all companies, and that's ultimately to the benefit of the end consumers. And so I thought, you know, maybe I'll try shaking it up. And, you know, ironically enough, at the same time, there were some other great individuals that were thinking the same thing, and some other vests came out the same year. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, originally when I just started, I think I told you this, Tim, like my hope was to be able to sell enough vests that I could afford to go hunt out of state every year, specifically, you know, for big game or elk, you know, go to Colorado or go to Montana or Wyoming and sure. hunt some big game as well, you know. And anyways, just started, you know, I mean, I'm a digital marketer. That's my background. That's what I've done for my entire life, essentially. And so just started doing things that I knew to do as far as, you know, kind of teasing and building the brand and designing mm-hmm. the logos and, you know, building a website and doing different things like that. And I have a hard time not going 100% at anything I do. So all of a sudden, you know, I'm doing more than I anticipated to build for it. And then I was like, you know, we'll see what happens. And anyways, we kind of teased and pre-built and talked about it and ultimately launched the business. We're going into our third year now, which is incredible. And I'm so grateful for that.
And how many vests would you say you've sold? And I know you introduced a new vest, you know, this year, which was the, what was your second one called again? I apologize.
The Legacy.
Legacy. But of the year. Summit, how many vests would you say you've sold at the Summit so far? How many Final Rise vests are out there?
A lot.
Well, good. I like to hear that. That's good. So I just, now, you know, again, and you touched on it, your inspiration for the Summit was, you know, build a better, right? You know, I mean, build a better mousetrap, right?
Absolutely. And that, you know, a lot of people, you look at some of the great vests that are out there and people are like, oh, well, how different can it be? You know, how much can you change it? And I kind of use the analogy as like, well, it's, you know, how many wheels can a car have, right? It's always going to have four wheels, but there's new cars every year. There's new this every year. And what mm-hmm. those cars or what those products are showcasing is the advancements in technology. And what I mean by that specifically in the material and textile space is there's better materials, there's stronger materials, there's better plastics, there's better components. Design features and understanding and you know, and also being able to infuse a lot of the ideologies that came from the backpacking space and the backpacking hunting experience that I have and bringing that into an upland vest. So while a lot of vests may look very similar, I always tell people an empty vest feels great. It's when you load it down and you're balancing and distributing the weight that it's going to shine. And not all vests are created equal in that regard. Alec talked about it earlier. Like, I anticipate going out carrying 8 to 10 pounds of water, bar none. Okay. I know that's going to be in my pack. I like carrying a full-size camera, you know, half a box or a box of shells, depending on what we're hunting for the day, first day, different things like that. And understanding how to load a backpack to appropriately carry very heavy loads. I mean, I've packed out full mule deer and half of an elk in one go and, you know, do all these different things. And you learn very quickly what you can and cannot do. And there were just certain design aspects in some of those existing products, not that they're wrong, but just that I don't feel like they were optimizing the potential of that product, mm-hmm. You know, big pockets where you were potentially putting the heaviest thing in your vest where it shouldn't be long. And so you'd see a lot of these vests that look like a saggy diaper, right? And you got stuff right. bouncing off your butt. And it's like, well, the weight doesn't belong there. You know, you want it above your waist. You want it close to your back. And so I tried to kind of make it foolproof and design it in a way that it's like, hey, no matter how somebody uses this product, for the most part, they can't do it wrong. Like, I'm not going to let them put things where they can't go. I've moved the pockets to the appropriate locations. I've put the shell pockets on the side so they're not bouncing off the front of your legs. I've lowered the sternum harness so the hardware and that buckle is sitting lower to not impede proper gun mount. I do not use any sort of padding in our shoulder harness. Padded shoulder straps are, to me, designed to offset a poorly designed waist belt, and you know, backpack shoulder straps don't belong on a strap vest. That's not what they're for. You're not wearing a backpack, you're wearing a strap vest. So there's just little things like that. And I'm not taking shots at any of the products out there. I'm not in any way, but
I don't think you hunt
long enough. I guess like this is really the culmination of all the gear experience and all the hunting experience that I've been fortunate to obtain. And I've taken everything that I can understand about those two, merged them together, brought in, you know, lighter, tougher, more durable fabrics, and put that into motion. And that's kind of what Final Rise is.
So let me ask you real quick here. Now you guys were talking and I got to play the dummy advocate because my dummy card, because Tim has shared with me his vest, his Summit vest. Now, I think it's, he won't let me wear it all day. So
I won't. In fact, and I was going to comment in there, you know, really got to watch Murph if you go on a road trip with him, guys. You know, I mean, he always offers to share everything. Anything I got, guys, is yours, but, you'll notice that some of your good snacks go missing real quick on that trip. You know, I'm just saying.
You mentioned the Legacy. Now, is that a different vest or is it the Summit would be for upland guys, the Legacy be for your backpack big game hunting? I don't know too much about it. Tell us a little bit.
That's a great question. I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit more about that. So, you know, the Summit really is our flagship do all any upland application vest. You know, whether it's the Grouse Woods or the Chukar Hills, it has the ability to really be used in a lot of those places. Now, for some certain applications or guys that may not be multidimensional in their species pursuit, and they may, you know, they just want to, they're just quail guys, or maybe they're just grouse guys. And they know what they want to hunt, and that's all they want to hunt. You know, everybody kind of has their niche. What the Legacy is basically a streamlined version of the Summit. And what I mean by that is on the Summit vest, you know, there's a lot of internal storage that's built into it. The game bag has three zippered pockets. There's one in the rear panel, one on each side of the bag. There's the bungee on the back. You know, I pick up a lot of shed horns, a lot of the places that we hunt. So I've got it. I can use the bungee to hold that or light jacket. We have the Molly webbing that's on the side and rear of the game bag. So you can attach additional storage pockets if you might need them. There's a lot of guys that carry quite the kit when they're afield. And it's bladder compatible as well. Obviously, being able to have those two water bottles and the bladder is very pinnacle in early season. And so the Legacy stripped away essentially a lot of the modularity as far as it doesn't have the Molly webbing on the game bag, so it's not compatible with any additional pockets. It does have a single zip, built-in zippered pocket. Has a little bit more simplified, just a classic flip-top pocket. That you see used on a lot of different vests, where our Summit has a little bit different pocket. And I know we're talking more about the Legacy now, but it was just a way to offer a really high quality American made product at a lower price point, which is what that vest kind of tapped into. And we were able to do that by reducing some of the materials and obviously some of the manufacturing time and not having to build in additional pockets, bar tack all the webbing, you know.
Well, sure, but for a guy like me, I'm 65 years old. You're 31. You ain't even made it halfway yet, buddy. So, I, you know, the Legacy would be, you know, because
you want not, the Summit, Murph. That's the one you need. I'm telling you right now, buddy. When we hang up here, you get on his website and you order one up.
I'm convinced that you're correct, but I'm just saying the Legacy to me, for a guy like me that's not gonna be, you know, I mean, you guys run up and down those hills out there and no big deal, but 65 you're starting to think to yourself, well, you know, 4 or 5 hours out and I'm ready to go home. But
correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, the Legacy does not come with water bottle holders on it, correct?
Specifically on the waist belt, you're correct, Tim. The sides of the game bag are designed to hold the water bottle holders. Now, an important note to touch on, because the waist belt and the shoulder harnesses that we use are the exact same. those are very two key design components of the Final Rise system and two of the products I feel really kind of separate our product line from others out there. So knowing that, we use that for both the Summit and Legacy. But the Legacy does have a location because it's the same waist belt. It does have a spot on the hip belt if people want to purchase water bottle holders as well. And I've had a lot of people do that, whether they just want a more simplified vest, but they do want to have, you know, the water bottles on the hip belt. And I mean, honestly, you can have two in the game bag and two on the hip belt. And I know a lot of Quail guys that do that as well. And that's kind of, I guess, the beauty of the Final Rise system in its entirety is it's very, very modular. Everything is plug and play. Every component on our vest is sewn individually. We just assemble them before we ship them to you, but it's all plug and play. You can move stuff around. You can find, you know, custom tailor that fit to you. No two bodies are the same. So a one size fits all vest is just not the solution, right? So, you know, between designing different sizes of waist belts and shoulder harnesses, you also have the ability to configure that system to fit what you're going to be hunting and what you're going to be carrying.
So what's the lead time now? If I was to order a vest today, am I 6 weeks? That's what Tim was saying. Is that still pretty much your standard lead time? No.
So, you know, we've been fortunate to keep growing and be able to add, you know, some headcount. We've got some individuals that are helping us sew, which has been an absolute lifesaver. And so right now, I would say this is the slowest time of the year. We're still plenty busy, but we're, you know, you're trying to hopefully get ahead to reduce, you know, longer lead times later in the season. But right now, 2 weeks is very realistic to be able
to
get it out there. And I mean, come hunting season, you know, there's a little bit of procrastinator in all of us. You know, it's like,
that's me. Yeah. You got me figured out.
July, August, September, and my phone doesn't stop ringing and we don't stop getting emails. So we're trying to get ahead of that now, but we're in a great position right now. So anytime someone calls me, I'm like, hey, if you want to make sure you have it, I would just encourage you to get one now.
Oh yeah. I have to, this is a testimony because anybody that has a cheap vest, and I've had a lot of them, and the vest I have now is far from the best. And I did pick Tim's brain about this, you know, because he's been, you know, I mean, he is happier than I don't even want to say what, but he is a happy fellow with that Final Rise vest and
a tornado in a trailer park.
I'm not going to say anything. This could be a, you know, it's a PG show, so we're gonna.
It is. That's fine.
So nevertheless,
put a PG comment in there.
I think that, you know, I mean, anybody that like that earlier, gear is really huge, and I've talked about it with a lot of my buddies. They said, well, you know, it's 95% of the reason you go hunt. I said, yeah. There's a lot of things you could look at that, because if I didn't have a shotgun, I wouldn't go hunting. If I didn't have a dog, I wouldn't go hunting. If I didn't have a good pair of boots, I wouldn't go hunting. I mean, you can factor your any type of gear into there. And I think the vest fits right into there as, you know, I mean, it's a must to have, a especially if you're going to, you know, be doing a longer journey. I mean, when we're out west, I mean, we're out all day, and you come in at night, and if you've got, you know, a sore lower back, it's your own fault for having, you know, cheap sure, whatever. So
sure. And that was me the year before. And I had a oil cloth strap vest I had, and, you know, gosh, my shoulders and back weren't sore from, you know, carrying a ton of birds. It was sore from the water. And just like you said, just the unbalanced, where everything was at, you know, and I love that vest. It was a great vest, and still have it in the bag as a backup. Obviously, guys, you know, and I can always advise you this, you know, we talk about road trip points, and not to take away from Matt here for a second, when you go on a road trip, pack two of everything, because if you forget something, at least you got your second one. And that was the case last I think the last trip we went on, Murph, I forgot the chaps, and one of our other partners, Rick, says, oh shit, what are you going to do? I said, well, I got a spare pair in the bag, you know? So yeah, pack double of everything, guys. But in, you know, the vest itself, like I said earlier, and it's not, you know, this is just my opinion of it. It's a great product. It sits well, it carries weight well. I think you nailed it spot on, Matt, you know, with everything, design and execution. So
So Matt, we were talking about Pheasant Fest earlier. It looks like you've got a booth there also. So you're gonna be at the show. Or you got any show specials for our listeners or anything? Or anything that they need to stop in and make sure that they just talk to you and see your vest? I'm sure of that. But is there you got any show specials going on?
Yeah, so we'll run a small show special. We're gonna do 20% off on our vests. And for anybody that's listening after that, I'm a big believer that sharing is caring. And we're, you know, I mentioned earlier, this will be our third anniversary, and just so grateful to be where we're at. So we're also going to extend that to our online audience shortly after Pheasant Fest. And it'll be a good time of year, hopefully help people get ahead of the ball a little bit, maybe incentivize them to make me not have to sew as much during hunting season, so I can get as much of that out of the way as possible. And just very excited to just show what we have. You know, we've been a direct to consumer business and likely always will be. I mean, being able to, the goal is to be
reel off that website, will you?
Just finalrise.com, super simple.
Finalrise.com.
Yes, sir. So, yeah, we're very excited. This will be the first trade show for us, and just very excited. I've been working probably more than I should, and just getting the booth set up. And I got to pack the trailer, and we got a little bit of weather here, and I'm gonna have to leave an extra day early to make sure I get there, and hopefully miss some potential highway closures. So it'll be a rodeo, but we're very excited and grateful to be able to get out there and kind of just let everybody get their hands on stuff.
What booths are you at? I know you said you had a double. Do you know what the numbers are off top head for our listeners?
Oh golly, I should. I think it's six. Oh golly, I'm embarrassed. It's 531, 530.
He's on the end. He's right down the center, over by the dogs, on an end cap, I think.
I think you're right on an end cap there. I looked it up. I just couldn't remember the numbers. So,
531 and 630.
There, 531 and 630. Okay, perfect. 531 and 630, guys. And, absolutely. So, Matt, I think we might have skipped over one. Let me ask this. You know, I know we're going through some challenging times right now with, obviously products and stuff like that and supply chain. Are you facing any problems with that or any struggles as a manufacturer coming up here?
You know, there's always something, Tim, but the fortunate thing, and maybe this is disclosing a little bit more than people need to know, but I've put every penny that we've raised from Final Rise back into it. I've mentioned I do have a full-time job, and that's enough to take care of what I need, but I'm a big believer in hopefully building something wonderful. And so, being able to have, a good cash flow and a healthy business and put that into materials, I have every single component, all the fabric, everything for what I've forecasted and hopefully we'll do in business this year. So the only potential bottleneck is manufacturing. And, sometimes it's hard to find folks that are willing to sit at a sewing machine and grind it out for hours on end. And I can mm-hmm. totally understand that because I've done that for 3 years myself. But the only constraints really just our output overall. We're in a great position material wise and won't have any delays there. So grateful that we are where we are and hoping it'll be a wonderful year.
That's fantastic, Matt. Thanks for sharing that with us. So definitely appreciate it. No problem. That's about a wrap for this episode. We really want to thank Alec and Matt for dispelling all the myths and confirming all the addiction stories of chucker hunting. Matt, we also appreciate you sharing the Final Rise story with our listeners. And again, guys and gals, I can't say enough great things about my Summit vest. Matt is truly producing some of the top tier hunting vests and equipment out there. So like these guys said, quality gear, quality gear, quality gear. You're heading out west. I don't care what you're chasing. Good boots, good pants, and to top it off, a good vest, guys.
One more reminder, though. If you're headed to Pheasant Fest, don't forget to stop by the various JGHB Club booths and visit with the club members. They're just waiting to talk to you about dogs. They're not trying to sell you anything. It's what you're doing is looking for your next dog a few years down the line. get a handle on all these different dogs and their testing and what goes into them. So, and also then swing by the Final Rise booth at 531 or and 630. It's an end cap booth. Check out all the great products. Matt's just explained a lot about them, but there's always more to talk about, I'm sure. And you know, you would get to Matt before he gets on Shark Tank and sells it or something. You know?
So. And don't forget that 20% discount. I know I'm going to be watching for that to drop to hop online. I won't make it to Pheasant Fest, so I'll have to wait till after Pheasant Fest to get my order in. But, you know, in closing, guys, we hope that our listeners have enjoyed the show as much as we did recording it for you. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to click the subscribe button on your player and be sure to like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram coming soon. And until next time, Weisman's Heil and Prost.